Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is sponsored by the law firm of Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, Pittman, with exclusive media sponsorship by the San Francisco Business Times. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the club's Board of Governors, and I will be your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, George Halverson, CEO of the Kaiser Foundation Health Plans. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan has been called the emperor of the HMO universe. Prepaid Kaiser Health Plans were first established around 1938. There's some argument about the exact date. And it was established by industrialist Henry J. Kaiser to cover the health needs of the employees of Kaiser Shipyards. George Halverson was named the CEO and chairman of Kaiser Foundation Health Plans and Kaiser Foundation Hospitals in 2002. Kaiser Permanente is the nation's largest nonprofit health plan with over 8.5 million members in 9 states and the District of Columbia, and boasts now about 13,000 physicians on staff. George Halverson has more than 30 years of healthcare management experience. He was formerly president and CEO of Health Partners and has held several senior management positions with Blue Cross and Blue Shield. He brings to the Kaiser healthcare system a broad background, including international experience as an advisor to the governments of Uganda, Great Britain, Jamaica, and Russia on issues of health policy and financing. And he is also credited with supporting the successful rollout of Kaiser's multi-billion-dollar information technology initiative, which helped him win the Modern Healthcare CEO IT Achievement Award. He is the author of several widely acclaimed books on the U.S. healthcare system, and in his soon-to-be-released book, Healthcare Reform Now, the subject of today's talk, Halverson points out that we spend more money on healthcare than any other country in the world, and yet nearly 50 million Americans are uninsured for at least part of the time each year. And to add insult to injury, well-documented studies show that 50% of Americans receive less than adequate and often unsafe medical care. George Halverson is the current president of the Board of Directors for the International Federation of Health Plans, and a member of the Harvard Kennedy School Healthcare Delivery Policy Group. He also serves on the Institute of Medicine Task Force on Evidence-Based Medicine and on the Commonwealth Fund Commission on a High-Performance Health System. It is now my pleasure to present the person who is continuing the tradition of innovative healthcare in America from the vision established by Henry J. Kaiser, started over 65 years ago, the current CEO of the Kaiser Foundation Health Plans, Mr. George Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. And thank you all for inviting me to have this conversation with you. It's a great honor to be invited to speak to the Commonwealth Club. Healthcare costs continue to climb in America. We are now at the point where the cost of family premium in California exceeds the per capita income of 147 countries. The total cost of healthcare in America now exceeds the gross domestic product of 254 countries. We are now spending $2.1 trillion a year in American healthcare. And yet, as you just heard, the number of uninsured people in America is increasing. We are close to the point where 50 million Americans are uninsured. Every other industrialized country in the world has universal coverage for all of its citizens. We spend roughly twice as much money per citizen on health care in this country, and we still have 50 million Americans without coverage. We spend more money than anyone, and we don't cover everyone. That should be a national disgrace and embarrassment to us all. So, are we getting the very best care in the world for spending all of that money? Many of the best care sites in the world are in America. If you need heart, lung surgery, you should get it in America. If you need Gamma Knife brain surgery, you should get it in America. This is the place to be for high-tech healthcare. But overall, it's pretty hard to argue that we're getting adequate value for the $2.1 trillion we're spending. Care in America is inconsistent, uncoordinated, and too often dangerous. The Institute of Medicine, comprised of some of our best, brightest, and most prestigious medical leaders, concluded that healthcare faces what the IOM calls a great chasm between the care we should be delivering and the care we actually deliver in America. The IOM said that American healthcare is, quote, a highly fragmented delivery system that largely lacks even rudimentary clinical information, resulting in poorly designed care processes. The result, they say, is a quality chasm in a non-system with enough safety issues that hospital errors alone in this country kill the equivalent of 2 747s full of passengers every day. Likewise, the RAND Corporation did an extremely important study that looked at the health care of 7,000 Americans. RAND compared the care people received to the care people should have received, based on the best available guidelines for health care. How often did we get it right? According to the RAND study, about half the time. Read the study. It's amazing data. Our success rate as a country, as an American infrastructure of care, was barely 50%. The Institute of Medicine agreed with that finding, saying more than 50% of the patients with hypertension, diabetes, tobacco addiction, hyperlipidemia, congestive heart failure, chronic atrial fibrillation, asthma, and depression are currently managed inadequately. For diabetes, the fastest growing disease in America and the number one cause of kidney failure, blindness, amputations, and the number one comorbidity causing death from cancer or from heart disease, for diabetes, the caregivers of America delivered the right package of care less than 50% of the time. There is a massive inconsistency in American healthcare. One of my favorite studies took 135 doctors and gave them all the exact same patient. They came up with 82 different treatments for that one patient. So why was that true? Because the doctors may have gone to medical school last month, last year, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. They may or may not have gone to a seminar on that topic. They may or may not have read an article on that topic. Various drug salespeople had called on the doctors, and that created additional variation. In any case, 135 doctors, one patient, 82 treatments. To make matters even worse, we have a major problem with racial and ethnic disparities in both our healthcare needs and our healthcare delivery. African American kids are 1.3 times as likely to have asthma, half as likely to be treated for it, and 4 times as likely to die from it. African American kids in many communities are also half as likely to have health insurance. A study was released last week about childhood injuries, and it documented that uninsured children who are hospitalized die of their injuries twice as often as the children who are insured. I could list 50 other examples. American healthcare has a great number of inconsistencies, and there is a high level of disparity. The patterns are the same. So what does this tell us about the outcomes of care? There are some major differences in care outcomes. Your 5-year mortality rate after having breast cancer surgery can be 60% higher depending on which surgeons you pick. The likelihood of having your mammogram read skillfully enough to detect your cancer early can vary by equivalent amounts. Cystic fibrosis is a great example of care variation. If you get your care from one set of caregivers and you have cystic fibrosis, you're likely to live another 33 years. Now, that's a huge improvement over prior treatment, but it's a lot less positive as an outcome if you know that the life expectancy at the best cystic fibrosis programs is 47 years. There is a great range of performance in healthcare in America. Consumers need data about caregiver performance and care outcomes. We also need systematic process improvement science and techniques applied to healthcare. Every other part of the U.S. economy has gone through extensive reengineering. The DVD players that cost $700 5 years ago cost $35 to $70 today, and they have better functionality and better performance. Now, how did that happen? Process improvement approaches were applied to the DVD production process. Healthcare as an infrastructure does not reengineer. How many care processes can you think of that cost $700 5 years ago and cost $70 today? If you know any, give them to me and I'll include them in future talks. Key problem for healthcare is data. Reengineering depends on data. When General Electric puts a process improvement program in place to achieve Six Sigma results with fewer than 3 errors per million units, the very first step in the GE Six Sigma process is data. GE could not achieve Six Sigma results with data. It's foundational and fundamental. Healthcare lacks data. Healthcare has a massive data deficit. Healthcare lacks production data, process data, unit cost data, and outcomes data. Healthcare lacks error rate data, and healthcare lacks comparative performance data. Reengineering and effective, well-designed process improvements are impossible without data. So why does healthcare lack data? Healthcare lacks data because the basic record-keeping process in healthcare is the paper medical record. The data is on paper. If a patient has 3 medical conditions, the patient typically has 3 paper medical records, 1 per doctor, kept in isolated files and generally not available for review or communication between caregivers. If a patient changes doctors, the patient files almost always stay with the old doctor. Now, when RAND did their wonderful study, they had to take 20 nurses and have them pull individual paper medical records from all of the physicians who saw all of those 7,000 patients. That study took more than 2 years to do, and it only gave us 1 snapshot of care performance for those 7,000 patients. And we do not know what happened to those patients a day later, a month later, or a year later, or in this case, 4 years later. To find out how those same patients are doing today, we'd need to gather another 20 nurses, spend 2 more years gathering the information, and then we'd still only have 2 data points on our care performance chart. 2 data points are not enough to keep track of $2.1 billion in healthcare spending. So our paper files are isolated, they're sometimes illegible, they're too often unavailable, and they are never interactive. Now, in an age of interactive databases, the paper medical record cannot advise a treating doctor about best practice, and the paper record cannot warn a prescribing doctor about possible drug interactions. Usually, the paper record doesn't even tell the prescribing doctor that another prescription exists, much less that the intervention, the interaction between the two drugs might be dangerous for the patient. Paper medical records are an absolutely anachronistic, extremely dysfunctional way of providing badly needed data to a data-dependent profession. We need all of that data computerized. We'd need not only to know, as the RAND study pointed out, that 1/2 of our diabetics received less than adequate care, we need to know exactly which diabetics received inadequate care, and we need the tools to help us make sure that everyone does get the needed care. So what do we need? We need an industrial revolution in healthcare. We need transparent, accountable, continuously improving data-based care. That level of care cannot and will not happen in a care delivery infrastructure reliant on a paper medical record. We need to track cancer survival rates by cancer type, by cancer stage, and by cancer caregiver. We need to track not only the number of mammograms that were given, but we also need to track how well those mammograms were read. We need programs to make sure that every kid with asthma is getting needed care, and that can only be done if the information is on a computer. And then it needs to be used for process improvement and reengineering, as well as caregiver information flows. Now, that's just common sense. We also need to put the right incentives into our healthcare economic system. The current economic incentives in healthcare are definitely problematic if you believe that incentives create behaviors. Let's look at how we pay our caregivers. We have over 9,000 billing codes for procedures, for units of care. We have zero billing codes for cures. We have zero billing codes for health status improvement. There is not one single billing code for process improvement. There's not one single billing code for care linkages. There are 9,000 billing codes for procedures. So what do we get? We get $2.1 trillion worth of procedures. More procedures than anyone in the world, with a woefully inconsistent performance and less than adequate outcomes. A major healthcare problem that results from our current non-system of care is what I call care linkage deficiencies. Now, care linkage deficiencies abound in our system. Caregivers do not connect well with other caregivers in America. As Don Berwick, professor at Harvard Medical School and the president and CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, says, a patient with anything but the simplest needs is traversing a very complicated system across many handoffs and locations and players, and as the machine gets more complicated, there are many more ways that it can break. Likewise, the Institute of Medicine says, for many patients, care for even a single condition is fragmented across many clinicians and settings with little coordination and little communication. So we have care linkage deficiencies everywhere. Now, doctors try very hard to do the right thing. All doctors want to do the right thing. Because American healthcare is an economic environment, doctors and other fee-for-service caregivers generally do the billable right thing. If it isn't billable in American healthcare, it tends not to get done. Care linkages are not billable, so care linkages tend not to happen. Those linkages are badly needed. Our patients who use the vast majority of our healthcare services typically have comorbidities. Comorbidities means multiple health problems. Multiple health problems means multiple doctors, usually from multiple specialties. Unless your caregivers are part of an integrated medical group, having multiple providers far too often means having providers who do not link, coordinate, cooperate, or collaborate on your care. So we need better care linkages in America. It is criminal and operationally dysfunctional to have the care linkage deficits that we have, and that's the way far too much care is delivered in America. What we really need in American healthcare is focus. The costs of care are not distributed evenly across the entire population. We're not in a situation where everybody uses an average amount of care. In the real world, 1% of our population uses 35% of our care dollars. 5% uses 60% of the care dollars. 10% uses 70%. On the other side of the coin, 70% of the population uses only 3% of the care dollars. 15% uses no care at all. So there is no need to focus on that low-cost 70% or the zero-cost 15% if we want to save money in American healthcare. That's not where the dollars are. That's obviously not where the opportunity is. Again, it's time to apply common sense to healthcare. Where should we focus? We need to focus on the five chronic conditions that drive 75% of our care costs in America. The big cost drivers that make America the most expensive healthcare infrastructure in the world are just five chronic conditions. It's diabetes, asthma, congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease, and depression. Five conditions drive 75% of our cost. It's not cancer care. Cancer gets a lot of visibility. Cancer only costs 5% of the total healthcare dollars. It's not maternity care. Maternity gets a lot of visibility. Maternity costs are only 4% of the total healthcare dollars. We need to focus our attention and our care reengineering and our care improvement efforts on the very few chronic conditions that create most healthcare expenses in America. We need to be particularly aware that the patients with comorbidities, the multiple medical conditions, are the most expensive patients and the ones who most need care linkages and systematic best care. One important study of people with chronic diseases found that while the likelihood of each chronic disease patient receiving any one of the correct treatments they need range from 40 to more than 90%, the likelihood of those same patients receiving all six or seven of the treatments they need dropped to under 8%. So now think of that. Under 8% of the people with those conditions receive the complete package that they need. So there's definitely room for improvement in American healthcare. Healthcare in America costs $2.1 trillion in large part because of that inconsistent, unlinked, uncoordinated, unfocused level of performance. This isn't rocket science. It's basic blocking and tackling relative to patients with a defined set of conditions. So what do we need next? We need a short-term focus on those five conditions. They drive 75% of our cost. We need better, more consistent care and better patient compliance with medical treatments. And those results can significantly improve the status of those health status of those patients and cut complications and cut the resulting cost of care by 10, 20, and even 30%, depending on the condition. There is no need to ration health care in America to make it affordable. We need to focus competent care on the people who need it the most. The numbers speak for themselves. Now let me take just both a short-term and a longer-term perspective for a minute. In the short term, we need a solid and immediate focus on best practices in medicine for those chronic care patients. We need to make sure that our people with diabetes have their insulin, our heart patients have their beta blockers, our patients with asthma have their inhalants, and our congestive heart failure patients have their medications and their early warning and their support systems. As the diseases progress, we know the right thing to do. We know who needs the right thing to be done. We need to do it. Each of those diseases has their specific medications. Let's take a slightly longer-term perspective for a second. It's extremely important to recognize that if we go back upstream, if we go back into the progression of each disease, there are a couple of extremely important things we could all do to reduce the likelihood of getting the three most expensive diseases in America. Behavior changes could have prevented heart disease, prevented coronary disease, and prevented diabetes for most people. And interestingly, the same exact changes of behavior prevent all three of those conditions. America is increasingly obese and inert. We are overweight and we do not exercise. The healthcare burden that results from that behavioral change is, that behavioral reality is immense. If you want to make healthcare affordable in America over time, we need to create a national culture of health. And we need to create an infrastructure that can support healthy behaviors. Trans fats should not be in our food. Vegetables should be. We need to walk at least 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week. One study showed that walking 30 minutes a day cut the incidence of new diabetes cases by more than half. More than 30% of all the money spent by Medicare is spent on diabetics. We would have a very different view of the long-term future of Medicare funding if we could cut the number of diabetics in half by preventing the disease. We need to build expectations about healthy behaviors into our national culture. Now, one of my favorite studies looked at a tribe of Native Americans located on both sides of the Mexican border. On the Mexican side of the border, the people farmed. The diet was local vegetables, corn, and free-ranging chickens. On the American side of the border, there were more TVs, fewer chickens, and more McDonald's. What was the result? On the Mexican side of the border, at age 65, less than 10% of the population had diabetes. On the American side of the border, at age 65, more than half the population had diabetes. Same tribe, same gene pool, same geography, same point in history, differences, diet, and activity levels. Healthcare costs are exploding in the U.S. We do know why. We need to deal with those cost creation issues very directly. Right now in this country, General Motors spends more money on healthcare than it does on steel. Starbucks spends more money on healthcare than it does on coffee. We need to do something about that, and we need to take the long view. So what should we do? We should reform healthcare in America. We should focus our energies on the key conditions that create the huge expenses. We should systematize care. We should computerize record-keeping about care. We should create data linkages and communication linkages between caregivers, and we should demand that those linkages be used. We should set up a marketplace where informed patients can make choices about their caregivers and their care. We should reward our caregivers for excellence and for process improvement. And we need process improvement, data, and informed choices in healthcare. And we need that approach now, not a decade from now. So I think it's time to take action. I also think, and let me conclude with this thought, I think it's time for universal coverage. We all need to do this healthcare reform agenda together. I strongly believe we need to create universal coverage now and cover everyone in America, and we can start by covering everyone in California. It is unconscionable to leave 50 million people out in the cold on health care. Universal coverage is extremely affordable if we do it right. Uninsured people in America do receive some levels of care now. Far too often, that care is delivered at the wrong point in the care process, and it's delivered at the wrong site of care. The emergency rooms of America have far too many people in them who should have been taken care of earlier in the care process at primary care medical sites. Uninsured people tend not to receive preventive care or primary care or early care, but the uninsured do receive catastrophic care and then often cannot pay for the cost of that catastrophic care. So what happens to the cost of that care? It is shifted to other payers. Cost shifting is not an evil deed, it's a necessary evil. Hospitals shift the cost of the uninsured to their insured patients by increasing their fees. So people who are insured have their fees for their care increased to pay already for the cost of the uninsured. In California, that cost shift to the private employers and to insured Californians equals about $1,100 per family contract per year. And if we decide to cover all Californians and subsidize the cost of care for the low-income uninsured by using the dollars that are now in the cost shift, those dollars are more than enough money to cover all of the uninsured in California. So there's a great irony, I think, in the fact that we already spend enough money to cover everyone. We just spend it in the wrong way, and we end up providing catastrophic care to the uninsured rather than comprehensive care to everyone. 3 years, if we do this, if we create universal coverage, 3 years after the cost shift has been ended because everyone is fully covered, if we designed the model appropriately, we could have a total health care bill in California that is no higher and possibly a bit lower than what we would pay in 3 years if we did not cover the uninsured. In other words, if we do this right, we can target a 3-year payback. 1, 2, 3, free. Universal coverage by using the cost shift to pay for it. So it's time to do universal coverage. One last point on universal coverage. most European countries who achieve universal coverage do it with a public-private mix. It's a mixed model. They don't use a simple single-payer system. If you live in Germany, Austria, Belgium, or Switzerland, you have an individual mandate by law to buy health care coverage. And you have many competing health plans to buy coverage from. A lot of people assume that Europe just uses the Canadian single-payer model as their path to covering everyone, and that is not true. If you live in Switzerland, you have an individual mandate to buy coverage, and you have 87 competing health plans to buy that coverage from. Germany has used the competing health plan model since Otto von Bismarck, and there are hundreds of competing sickness plans in Germany. I mention that because some people believe that the only pathway to universal coverage is single payer, and that universal coverage and single payer go hand in hand everywhere in the world. That is not true. Each country finds its own pathway to universal coverage, and I think it's time for us to find our own pathway here. I personally believe we'd be very well served if we were to do what most European countries do, create an individual mandate that requires everyone in America to have coverage, and then we need to make that coverage very affordable, if not free, for all low-income people. I think we need to end the cost shift in care, use that money to cover the uninsured, and as a first step, I strongly believe that everyone below 100% of the federal poverty level should be on Medicaid. We should cover all kids, and then we should use an individual mandate to cover everyone else. I think it's time for that to happen in America. So those are a couple of thoughts about where we are and where we need to go. Conclusion, we need to focus. We need data. We need continuous improvement. And we need to cover everyone. So I'd be very happy to answer any questions you might have. And I thank you for giving me this opportunity to offer some thoughts about healthcare reform in America. Thank you.
Our thanks to George Halverson, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan and Hospitals, for his comments today. I am Chris Robber, healthcare reporter for the San Francisco Business Times, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. Mr. Halverson, we have a number of questions, so let's begin. And that is an understatement. Everything from nutrition to what has Kaiser done right and wrong this year or last year. I'll start with an easy one. Did any of the 135 doctors get the diagnosis right?
Yes, there were actually, in that particular case, a couple of different treatments that were good. most of them got the diagnosis right and used inappropriate treatments. Some of the treatments were the right drug for the wrong duration. Some were the wrong drug, all kinds of errors in the process. A small number got it right. In that particular instance, with that particular condition, the number who got it right initially was under 10%.
Okay. That's good to know. At least some of them got it right. Now, this is a...
One of the beauties of healthcare is that the body heals itself most of the time.
Now... Here's a much tougher question. I've been covering healthcare since about 1990, and people have been talking about healthcare reform ever since. Been talking about getting rid of the uninsured problem ever since. The Clinton healthcare plan bit the dust in the early 90s. We've tried managed care. We've tried, using the market method of controlling costs and improving quality. We've tried healthcare information technology. We're trying consumer-directed health plans and HSAs, health savings accounts. Nothing seems to have worked so far. And the political, what's the chance politically and economically of the stars aligning themselves for a national healthcare reform package that actually is implemented and actually gets tested and work and put into effect?
That's a good question. I think the stars are better aligned than they've ever been, and they're better aligned for a number of reasons. One is that healthcare costs are so high right now that the American industry has reached a tipping point. People are ready for a change. The same people who were fighting healthcare reform back in the Clinton years are all saying we need to do something better and we need to figure out a different path to it. I think that's one issue. Second issue is the availability of medical best practices. There's an understanding in the world right now that we could focus our attention on the high-cost people with chronic conditions in a systematic way using available computer technology and actually transform care, make it affordable, make it better for everybody, And so I think there's a sense that there's actually a clinical pathway to affordable universal coverage that's there. I think that as we look through the country right now, every legislature in the country is offering multiple bills. There's just kind of a critical mass building of people ready for it. The other thing I think is true this time is the last time we got to this point back in the Clinton administration, everybody was a purist. Everybody insisted that if it's not my exact model, it's not going to pass. And the models were complex and in different directions. So everybody wanted reform, but everybody's second choice was status quo. And nobody and everybody's reform had to be their particular model. I think what we're seeing this time is the willingness on the part of everyone to collaborate. I think the governor of California is talking about a model where everybody pays their share, everybody's involved, and I think there is a sense, and I think some of the surveys that have been done lately show that the public is ready for that as well, a model that everybody sort of pays into. And so I think we're smarter now, and I think there's a high level of energy now, and I'm actually optimistic that we could pull it off. I think it would be a horrible shame if we don't.
Care to place the odds on California implementing a reform package this year?
I think it's at least 50-50.
Okay. I'll go to a question from the audience. How did the statistics you mentioned regarding the quality and success rate of the U.S. Healthcare compare with those of other countries? Is the U.S. healthcare system overall better or worse than the majority of other countries?
A lot of other countries invest very heavily in primary care. Other countries, if you are in Britain, France, many of those other countries, there is an extensive infrastructure of primary care. Everybody has a primary care doctor, and where they tend to save money is back on the tertiary care side. But what they do is they have fewer people with complications of diabetes because they've done a better job up front on the primary care side. And so it depends what you're measuring. If you're measuring who does the best job of coronary artery bypass surgery, we may win that one. If you're measuring who has the smaller number of people who need it, all the health status indicates that other countries win.
Okay. Now, in the news right now, Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C. is in the news for providing shoddy and inappropriate care for injured soldiers, as well as a lack of accountability until very recent days by senior military officials. That only changed when the Washington Post wrote about the situation. Any comments on what this situation has to say about the need for health care reform of a comprehensive kind? And also, are there any lessons there for an organization like Kaiser, which has also had some problems with various quality issues in the last year or so?
Interesting question. I think one of the things that we need in American health care is an extreme high level of transparency. I think people need to have a sense of what's going on relative to caregiver performance, institutional performance. I think the safety levels need to be public. I think the problem levels be public. And I think when you get that kind of transparency, improvement happens. I think what's going on in Washington right now is transparency has been applied to a particular setting that had been invisible, and the result of the transparency is actually a certain amount of momentum in favor of it. So I think that's a good thing. And I think as we go forward, what we need is a healthcare delivery system where we have consumers able to go to the internet and get information about caregivers and caregiver performance at a level far beyond anything we've had before. So I think that's all good. I can't think of any particular relationship between what's happening in Washington and anything that's happened recently at Kaiser. I don't think it's a linkage that comes to mind.
Well, I have to read a periodic reminder here, and then I'll give you an example. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is George Halverson, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Kaiser Foundation Health Plans and Hospitals, who is giving his views on reforming the nation's health care system. So my question referred to the problem with the kidney transplant unit in Northern California that had to be shut down. A number of patients were transferred to UC San Francisco and UC Davis Medical Centers. Kaiser was fined by the Department of Managed Health Care and sanctioned by the National Organ Transplant Association, and received some bad reports from the Department of Managed Health Care and the Medicare Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. A lot of people feel like Kaiser didn't really respond, the leadership didn't really respond adequately to that situation.
Well, let me take this opportunity to respond. That particular program is a program that it's somewhat painful even to talk about, but the program as it was set up an excellent transplant program. The transplant unit was well staffed, it had excellent people, it had very competent nurses, caregivers. The transplants themselves done in the unit were extremely successful, and in fact it was probably the most successful transplant unit in California. If you look at the results, the death rate from transplants was under 1%. And so there's nobody else in the state that has an under 1% death rate from the transplants. So very good program, excellent program. we closed it down because we were transferring people from one set of transplant lists to our set of transplant lists, and we did the transfers very badly. The transplants were good. The transfers were done very badly. We did not anticipate how complicated that was. We talked to the people and at UNOS who were involved in that process, and we said, what does it take to transfer people from one list to another? They gave us an estimate. We relied on that estimate. And what's interesting about that was they assumed we were talking about transferring one person. They didn't think we were going to transfer 2,000 people. So when we transferred 2,000 people from one list to another, and they were geared up to transfer one or two people every day, the process didn't work. We fell way behind in the transfers. The process didn't get the people from one list to the other, and so we ended up with people in list limbo and didn't realize that. And by the time we realized it, we ended up closing the entire program down and moving people back to the other list. And the list limbo problem is so difficult that now, as we're trying to move people back, 6 months later, we still haven't gotten them all back because UNOS, who had the same problem bringing him over, is having the same problem moving him back. But in terms of the program, it's very painful. About the week before the story hit the paper about how challenged that program was, we just had a party for about 40 people who were in that unit who had just had successful transplants and were all celebrating the transplant. So we shut down the program. I think California would be better off if the transplant part of that program was still alive, but we really did screw up on the administrative side of those transfers.
Okay. I may go back to that later, but we'll try another question now. Question from the audience, though, if you're born in the United States, your life expectancy is about 10th in the world, according to this questioner. But I understand if one reaches the age 70, the U.S. is the first in life expectancy. Does this explain where the U.S. is spending the money for health care, and is it spending it in the right areas?
The question, older people... Actually, one of the things I saw years ago in some actuarial studies is that once people reach a certain age, and it was about, I think, 85 or 90, the people who get there have already been selected in favor of. These are healthy people who have healthy lifestyles, who are doing all the right things, good genes. And that particular set of people tends to live a fairly long time. So if you can get to that point, if you do get to that point, you probably have all kinds of things in your favor already. So the fact that there's a longevity for people who are older, I don't think says as much about the healthcare delivery system as it speaks to the genetics of the particular people who got to that point. Mm-hmm. I do agree, though, that on the front end, we are having some real issues relative to comparative problems. Our death rate for our infant mortality rate lists us about 37th or 38th in the world. I mean, we've got some real issues in a number of areas. And one of the problems that, if you sort through the data and you take out the uninsured minority Americans, you end up with data that looks an awful lot like our insured data looks like the rest of the insured world. It's when you throw in our 50 million uninsured that you really get that, which is why we're arguing that there ought to be two data reports for America. There ought to be a data report for America showing our performance with the insured population and one showing our performance with the uninsured population. The other point I'd make on that is it, relative to racial and ethnic disparities, which I talked about earlier, in this country, we've solved issues on voting rights, we've solved issues on a lot of hiring issues. Many of the horrible inequities of the past are gone. The last great area of disparity that's really outstanding that we ought to be ashamed of is healthcare. And right now in California, 75% of the uninsured people in California are minority. Now, I talked earlier about the difference in health income and health status that results from not having coverage. We should be ashamed of that 75%, and we should be fixing it, if for no other reason, to make sure that our citizens have equal treatment.
Thanks. Another reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is George Halverson, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan and Hospitals, who is giving his views on reforming the nation's healthcare system. Another question from our audience, what is Kaiser doing about gathering data on medical errors? How are you evaluating the company and comparing yourself to others on this front?
On medical errors, one of the things that we're doing at Kaiser Permanente right now is computerizing our entire care system. We're spending a lot of money. I talked earlier about the problems of the paper medical record. We're spending a lot of money computerizing everything, computerizing our clinical care, pharmacies, hospitals, total care system, because we want a complete set of data on everything. We want to be able to do research, we want to do follow-up, we want to be able to impact on patients, we want to be able to embed in the system the kinds of reminders and prompts that help caregivers do the right thing, because we know that a system that doesn't have those kinds of prompts embedded in it systematically is going to have shortcomings. So we're basically, in terms of the process, going forward to reform healthcare in part by computerizing healthcare, and then that allows us to track healthcare. And so we want to make sure that we have the complete database so we know what works, what doesn't work, and we can track issues like error rates, but also outcome rates. And that's all extremely important to us. One of the things that people forget is that when the data, when the Vioxx situation hit a while ago and people discovered that there was actually a medical downside from taking Vioxx, that was actually Kaiser data. We did the first study on that. We sorted through our database. We took a look at the people who had taken Vioxx and discovered there was a much higher percentage of people having heart attacks. And we published that, and we started that whole chain of events that ended in the Vioxx thing. We've had several other events like that where we've identified information and as a result of that made a difference in healthcare. Most medical research in healthcare depends on clinical trials with very small numbers of people. They're very time limited. When they're over, and there's no follow-up, and you do not know what happened to the people a day later. And the medical system we're putting in place will have all of the information about all of the patients, all of the time, so we can do the interrelationships every day. In the RAND study I talked about that had the 7,000 patients and 20 nurses, took 2 years to do it, we could do that same study every afternoon at 4 o'clock with 8 million people and track longitudinal. So the goal is to have complete information about all the patients, and then as part of that, error rates are part of that. So, and internally within our system, we've set goals for and targets and objectives, and so all of that's part of our way of running ourselves.
Okay. Another question from the audience. A recent report card on hospital care, which was the Cal Hospital Compare website that just went up, rated Kaiser as below average in treating pneumonia. Would you care to comment? And I think the website rated some Kaiser hospitals as below normal or poor in some areas and above normal or better than normal in other areas.
Yeah, we actually had a whole range on that particular agenda, what I would suggest on that particular one is that if you take a look at where we will be in 2 years, the question will be who is behind us, because there won't be anybody in front of us. I mean, this is one of those areas where we're focusing, and they actually started the focus a little while ago relative to care performance. Some of our hospitals right now are the tops in the state. Others, we got a range. Others were on the bottom. We've got a bunch in the middle. And the goal is to systematically move everybody to the top.
Okay, thanks. Another general question from the audience. Please comment on the attrition of general practitioners or family practitioners in the U.S. and also here in California. How does this impact medicine, and how can we create more family practitioners?
Yeah, it's actually kind of ironic that at the point in time when we need more primary care doctors and there's a sense that the great opportunities in healthcare are on the front end, it's a time when we have a shortage of doctors going into the front end. In fact, when you look at the medical schools, the residencies are filling up on the specialty side, and on the primary care side, they're not filling. We're going to have to do a number of things. Part of it is reimbursement, because primary care doctors make less. Part of it is reengineering the delivery of care, setting up a care model that's more primary care friendly. One of the things we're finding in some of our pilots, we actually have a series of pilot programs going on designed to use the computer system to actually make the care delivery process more primary care friendly. And some of those projects are set up to enhance the practice model for primary care doctors, and the initial response from that have been extremely good. The pilots are showing that the doctors are much happier with that approach, and the morale goes up. So it also, interestingly, the efficiency goes up. Computer-supported care is a good thing. So, but you're right, it is a problem and something that needs to be dealt with, and it's also along the same lines. There's an equivalent, if not greater, nursing shortage. We're really running into a huge shortage of nurses in this country, and if we don't plan better and start committing the right resources, we're not going to have enough nurses and we're not going to have enough primary care doctors.
Okay. A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is George Halverson, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan and Hospitals, who is giving his views on reforming the nation's healthcare system. Next question, I'm going to combine several questions, but basically there's questions about Senator Stark's proposal to extend Medicare coverage to everyone, similar proposal by Sheila Kuehl here in California, questions about comparing the U.S. to Canada, where the questioner says they spend half per patient that what we do but get better results. Not everyone agrees with that analysis, but why shouldn't we? What are the main reasons that we shouldn't consider a single payer system?
I think we need universal coverage, absolutely. Relative to having a single payer system, anytime you get to a pure single payer system, you end up with a care system that rations. If you go up into Canada and you look at the hospitals, this point's made in many different ways, but there are no MRIs, there are very few CAT scans, the subspecialty in the tertiary care is relatively non-existent. Canadian patients come into the U.S., they do a great job on primary care, which is the thing I talked about earlier. They do not do as great a job on the back end, but rationing is what happens. The federal government rationed in this country, the areas that the government is responsible for are areas where rationing happens. The Medicaid population doesn't get the benefits it needs. The Medicaid program is pulled back every year because it's a government program. Medicare rationed drug coverage for its entire existence until recently and then designed a very odd benefit package that rations drug coverage in the middle. Anytime, if you want a good case of single payer, look at the medical care in our prisons. I mean, the government is completely and totally responsible. It's a single payer system, and they end up having budget constraints outweigh quality constraints, and the budget constraints end up with a situation that looks like tertiary care in Canada, non-existent care. And so our lawmakers, if saddled with the responsibility for maintaining the quality of American health care are likely to ration as much as every other set of lawmakers stuck with that same accountability would ration. So ideal marketplace is a marketplace where consumers make choices, the best providers compete on being the best providers, information is available to everyone, there is coordination between caregivers, and you focus on the patients who are running up the huge cost burden and help those patients be healthier, not lose their kidneys, not go blind, not have the amputations. And that's very possible. All of multiple studies have shown that that level of focus has a big improvement in healthcare. And as I said earlier, if we could cut the number of diabetics in Medicare in half, we could stop worrying about the long-term cost situation for Medicare.
Okay. I'm going to combine an audience question with one of my own. The question from the audience asks about the Veterans Affairs system and what they say they've done a great job on computerizing data, which is remarkable for a government bureaucracy. Should we take a lesson from this? And my corollary to that is Kaiser has its own large Health Connect information technology electronic medical record system. Could you compare what you're doing to what the VA has done and is doing, and also talk about some of the pluses and minuses of your experience so far with Health Connect?
Good question. We share information with and work closely with the VA. They've done a wonderful job. They pioneered computerizing healthcare, and they put together a system that works very well for their hospitals and their care system. They have better data, better outcomes, better quality, higher safety levels. It's been a very good program for the VA, and we actually have all kinds of sharing and linkages that go on with them. We're doing the same thing relative to our care. We're computerizing the care process. KP Health Connect is connecting all of our patients, all of our doctors, all of our caregivers. It's creating the database I talked about. And the beauty of the system is you put all of the information on the file so you know everything about every patient. That's the first step. But then what you do is you have an additional set of programs that sit on top of that program. And the additional programs scan through the database and they identify which patients didn't get their diabetic checked, didn't get their blood sugar checked, which patients need follow-up. And you identify care algorithms and apply them to the database, and then you give each doctor, and this is a wonderful program, you give each doctor a list of their patients that need follow-up. And one of the very nice things about the system is the number of patients that comes in for initial care goes down by 7 or 8% because ordinarily a lot of patients come in for their care and the tests aren't ready or the information's not there and they have to come back a second time. So you eliminate the rework, you create capacity, and then you use that capacity to focus on the patients who most need care. And what you end up with is a far more efficient system that delivers better care and ultimately delivers better care for less money. So we love the approach. It's the right thing to do. And the rest of the world is actually watching us. The other program in the world of comparable size is the government of Great Britain. And they're attempting to go down the road and computerize their care delivery. We've had hundreds and hundreds of doctors from Great Britain come over and look at us, study what we're doing. We've had all kinds of interactions with them, and we're in kind of a sharing teaching mode with that government as well. So I think actually that all of the really big care systems in the world are going to end up computerizing fairly quickly, and then the smaller individual practices are going to follow along. But it's the right thing to do, and this is the perfect time to do it.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to combine a couple of questions here, and we're running out of time, so we'll have to be brisk here. But one questioner asks basically, how can patients own information when they say providers do not support self-care, and how can reengineering occur if providers are organizing cartels, which they describe as Kaiser, Catholic Healthcare West, Sutter, and other large hospital systems here in California?
I'm not sure I understood the question in that question.
Well, I think the questioner is basically saying providers are organizing cartels and keeping patients, consumers, from you know, sort of owning their own information, owning their own health care, in a sense.
I can't speak to the cartel part of that issue, Nate, but in terms of owning information, one of our commitments is to give all of our patients all of their information all of the time. And so one of the things that if you're a Kaiser member and your medical record is on the computer, you have access to your medical record whenever you want that access. You get information sent to you directly. You can do e-scheduling, you can do e-visits, you can do secure messaging with your doctor. The whole electronic interaction with the patient is set up so that it's at the patient's convenience, but also so that the patient owns the information. So there is in no sense on our part at all, at any level, an attempt to withhold that information from the patient. Our agenda is just the opposite. Our agenda is to make sure that every patient gets all the information. And also, when I talked about that wonderful scanning process that goes on over the system, it's to make sure that the patients are not only have the access to the information, but we also know which patients need to come in for follow-up, which patients need a diabetic check. So it's an interactive process, not a cartel process.
Okay. Well, let's see. We have 1 minute left. Why don't you see what you can say about Governor Schwarzenegger's plans, chances of success, in 1 minute or less?
1 minute or less. I think it's not entirely coincidental that it looks a little bit like the Austrian national plan. I think that the governor's chance of success is actually pretty good because I think there are some. I think the speaker is inspired to go forward and create health care reform. I know Senator Parada is moving forward in health care reform. I think the labor leaders of California are moving together in health care reform. I think there are a lot of people lining up right now for health care reform. And I think the governor is being very collaborative in this approach. He's bringing people to the table and trying to create a collaborative approach. So I think he's taking the right approach. I think it's a good model. And I'm really hoping that he succeeds.
Okay. Well, I guess we're out of time here. Our thanks to George Halverson, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan and Hospitals. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. Tonight's program has been sponsored by Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman and with exclusive media sponsorship by the San Francisco Business Times. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you all.